Welcome back. Daniel Levitin is with us. Bill Russell, I, Paula. The notion of context really takes me where I want to be for a while, which is rock and roll. As I was reading This Is Your Brain on Music, it was remarkable to me that 99% of the time when you would name a song, I heard it in my head. I could call it up.
You were born at the right time.
I was born at the right time. I was born in the West. I
was born with... Was this call and response over here?
We could do a little gospel here, couldn't we? And we would be influenced by it. All of those things do come together in music. It's fun to talk about the neuroscience. It's also fun to talk about where you came from. And to then the joy that must be right at the heart of what you do is you don't have to pick.
Yeah. Well, you know, I was born... You know, you talk about context and the Heideggerian notion of context, which is interesting because I think Heidegger and Einstein were onto the same thing, but from different, I mean, Sein und Zeit, right, being and time, and Einstein's connection to time and energy and space was crucial. When was time, was being in time published? Was that before Einstein?
I think it
was after the general theory.
Yeah.
But I'm not...
Bill would tell me to go Google it. Wouldn't you, Bill?
Yeah, those of you who have the option, go find out what the truth is in this.
Right.
The fact,
It was an interesting synergy of two people looking at the same thing from different...
And it was at a very tumultuous time in the intellectual community. It wasn't just Einstein who came up with this. It was Einstein in the context of lots of people, and Niels Bohr was doing his stuff. And
exactly.
So all of this happening... affected the kind of music that they created of the spheres.
Yeah.
Forgive me if I'm taking that too far.
No, I think that's right.
But there is an overriding sense of big ideas here, including rock and roll.
Well, and so you talk about context. For me, I was born in Northern California, just on the other side of the hills from Berkeley and San Francisco. I grew up in the 50s and 60s. And the Jefferson Airplane and the Quicksilver Messenger Service and Moby Grape and Santana and the Grateful Dead were just, Janis Joplin, they were just 5-6 miles away.
And they were just coming into their own.
And they were the hometown band. They were the local bands.
You could go sit and listen to them.
Yeah.
You didn't have to go to a concert. You didn't even have to go to the park. I remember sitting this far away Jefferson Airplane, Grace Slick, and Dizzy Gillespie on the same stage, Basin Street West.
Yeah.
You know, they were on stage. They were playing from Surrealistic Pillow. I mean, this was music as it used to be, almost. They, you know, it was intimate. It was not.
And
the
you
kind
were
of,
part of it.
Not the concert. No.
Yeah.
Well, I was the spectator, as we've come to do that.
But they it was were not, very conscious of the audience. It what you were.
It was not arena, which I think is one of the great tragedies now of music, isn't it? I mean, I don't want to get off on that probably, but it seems that you know the progression of rock from this intimate, from the jazz like, from the blues like.
Well, you were talking about evolution earlier, and I guess I'd like to make the point that. From an evolutionary perspective, going back tens of thousands of years, music was always participatory. And in fact, if you look at most cultures in the world today, it is participatory. And by that, I mean everybody is making music together. And you have these images of, you know, savages or primitives, which is, of course, not what they were, but, you know, hunter-gatherer people, village-oriented societies around the campfire. Everybody was playing music. It wasn't two or three experts putting on a show for the rest.
And the playing might have been somebody stamping their feet and the other doing an alm for all we knew.
Yeah, and there was a lot of movement. And movement and dance and music were all the same thing. So much so that in the majority of the world's languages, the word for music and the word for dance are the same word. They didn't need to make a distinction because you never did one without the other. So what we've seen in the last 500 years in the West, I mean Western society, is a progression towards a class of experts who make music for the rest of us. And as rewarding as that is, and as aesthetic an experience as it is in some sense counter to our historical nature. And I think what we've lost is a sense that music is for everybody. The Greeks used to say that a measure of a society's sophistication is how many of the members of the society participate in the arts. And fewer of us participate in the arts today, other than finger painting as kids, we're told that, oh, well, you shouldn't draw because you're not good enough. You shouldn't dance because you're no Baryshnikov. You shouldn't sing, you're no Ella Fitzgerald, you know, Mariah Carey. And I think that's a tragedy.
We were talking about Ian Tattersall just before we began. Ian Tattersall distinguishes between anatomically modern humans and behaviorally modern humans. Anatomically going back plus or minus 200,000 years, behaviorally guessing 50, 60, 70,000 years. And when you
language.
Well, when you ask him, what is the distinguishing characteristic? He said it's a problem because we don't have the right kinds of records we'd like to have. But his flat answer is art.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Now, what is available, of course, is Lascaux and similar kinds of things, and the flute. And it seems to me, particularly if we step away from the language bigots, to put it gracelessly,
the mechanical language bigots,
that perhaps if music was in fact a precursor, or at least paralleling, and you make a compelling argument that it is a precursor, then
to language,
then behaviorally modern humans would seem to be defined very plausibly by music and dance, that one word.
Tattersall has this very nice phrase where he's talking about the art that the art objects found in Europe around 50,000 years ago. And he says, in every respect, those people were us. Mm-hmm. And the question, of course, for archaeologists and anthropologists and all of us studying this stuff is what happened between 200,000 years ago and 50,000 years ago. Now, on the music side, it's difficult because unlike visual art, music doesn't leave any remnants. There was no way to record it. We've only had recording for 100 years. We've only had an accurate system of notating music for about 500 years. So what we have going back, 1,000 years or 10,000 years, maybe we'll have some lyrics. I just discovered some lyrics from a Sumerian song that are 6,000 years old. We don't know the music, but we have the text. And it was clear that it was supposed to be music. The Psalms of the Songs of Solomon, the Psalms of David, mm-hmm. were music. But from an archaeological or cognitive evolution standpoint, there's no record. But what you can do about filling in the gap between the 200,000 years to the 50,000 years portion of it is to make an inference. If they already had flutes 50,000 years ago, they must have had things like banging on your knees and on your chest, Bobby McFerrin style, and, just singing and drumming. Those things had to come first. The flute is relatively sophisticated. And so you can imagine that for 50,000 or 100,000 years before we got to the flute, there was singing and dancing that would have been very similar to what we see today.
Add to that, Walter Freeman, whom we met many, many years ago, and I was so ignorant of his larger work that I focused on the consciousness, which was the subject of why we had all come together. They'd all come together and I got to come watch. He makes a very strong argument that this all starts with listening to our mama's heartbeats when we're in the womb, that music, and in fact he would, at that moment, I don't know, he may have changed his mind, but that he would put music right at the heart of consciousness, that which is a foundation, a floor from which consciousness emerged, and he's very big on the emerge part, would be that fundamental rhythm that comes when we are in utero of being so dependent on, and this is pure evolutionary thinking, that's where our little brains that are growing into a bigger brain inside our mamas, that heartbeat is where music begins, and then you go to the rhythmic things and then speech and all that other stuff. But he goes directly to that physical experience. And all of these things of which you speak are about physical experiences as well as thinking about thinking, yes?
Yeah. Well, there's no denying that the auditory system of the fetus is fully functional by 20 weeks. And
that's the first one, isn't it? Of the sensory systems?
That I don't know.
I have been told that it's the first one.
Okay.
I could be wrong. Well, think about it. Tell me when you figure out if I'm right or wrong.
Well, we could Google that.
Yes, we could.
20 weeks, so the developing infant has a long time in there, in the womb, and of course it's going to hear the mother's heartbeat. It's going to hear sounds from the environment, and we know that infant auditory preferences in music are shaped already during the second and third trimester of listening to music through the amniotic fluid.
You also, and you know, here pick up on Friedman. You also, in the latter part of this book, talk about the music in the broad sense as being a precursor of thinking, and you make again a compelling case, but share that case with those.
When we return in just a moment with Daniel Levitin on the Paula Gordon Show, Bill Russell, I, Paula, Dr. Dan, we all invite you to be with us when we return in a moment.